Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Pleiser, the owner and lead writer. Joining me, as always, my co-host and artist for Smugby Games, Kenneth Olm.
Hey there.
And our special guest from Clay Entertainment, the lead designer behind Mark of the Ninja, Nels Anderson.
Hello.
It's great to have you on, Nels.
Yeah, thanks. This is totally a cool thing to do.
So, Mark of the Ninja was definitely a great game. It was one of my personal favorite games of last year.
I like where this is going already.
Yeah, we're going to suck up to you for, like, the next hour. with Mark of the Ninja, was this your first project at Clay, or did you work on any of their previous titles?
Kind of. I actually did a very small stint at Clay way back in 2008, 2009, for like 3 months, when Clay was making a game that actually never shipped called Sugar Rush. It was like it was free to play back in the days when that was novel. Like it was like a co-production with Nexon, like the big Korean Nexon. But it was through Nexon's office here in Vancouver, and then things weren't going well with that Nexon branch. The game we were working on was good, but the rest of the Nexon branch wasn't doing very well, so Nexon back in Asia pulled a plug, and then Clay didn't have anyone paying the bills anymore. And so since I was the most recent hire, at that time I moved to Hothead Games, where I worked on Deathbank, and then I came back to Clay, did like a month of like very vague level design concepting on Shank 2, but it was basically just all ninja all the time.
Well, yeah, here's a question, by the way, because it came up from our previous cast. What happened to Sugar Rush? Is that, because it's on your site.
Yeah, I'm sure it is mentioned. I mean, like, I don't know legally if we got the rights back when Nexon pulled the plug or what, but yeah, I don't expect that will be a game that will ever be released. It made sense back in 2008, but today it's a the video games world is a pretty different place.
Okay,
definitely. So with Mark of the Ninja, where did like the original concept for the game come from?
So what was signed with Microsoft was a 2D game that involves a ninja. And that was basically it. Like, what we did, and this was actually before I came back, was like a gameplay demonstration video was put together. Like, kind of like a this is what the gameplay would feel like, but it was all totally faked in Flash, right? Just because it takes way less time to make a video than it does to make a whole engine and do all the input and all the rest of that stuff, right?
It's a
reasonable thing to do. So that video was shown to Microsoft and signed, but it wasn't like, you know, it was basically like a tone piece. It wasn't binding, right? So then when I came back and, you know, kind of the what the heck is this game actually going to be about? You know, I pushed very, very, very hard to make it a stealth game, because that's always like a true dyed in the wool, like Looking Glass lineage type stealth game, because that's a genre, style, whatever, that I've always found very interesting, that I have a lot of affinity for personally, and that hadn't really been done in 2D, which was both good and challenging. Yeah, and so that's kind of how the thing ended up. That's kind of how it came about. Like, you know, because from the outset, basically, it could have, like, if we'd wanted, Microsoft would have been totally cool with it being like a far more brawlery, like almost harkening back to the 2D Ninja Gaidens, right? Yeah. But we kind of didn't want to pigeon ourselves as like the 2D brawler studio. So we wanted to do something different.
Yeah. And you actually answer your sort of kind of to my next question regarding the stealth genre. So,
huzzah!
So are you, I assume that you're a huge fan of the genre. What were some, besides the Looking Glass games, was there any stealth game in particular that really helped, like, influence the design of Mark of the Ninja?
Yeah, I mean, Thief was definitely the biggest one. Secondary to that, you know, they're kind of like the other big canonical ones, right? Like, the Metal Gears and the Hitmans and the Splinter Cells and Tenchu to a lesser extent. because they kind of went downhill after the first one. Yeah, but kind of like, you know, all the different pieces in that style. Even some of the more recent stuff, like the sneaky bits from Rocksteady's Arkham Batman games. Lots of different influences in that regard. I'm certainly not above lifting or reappropriating or modifying or whatever good ideas when they exist.
Yeah. So Stellatron, it definitely has seen, you know, it's definitely been like changing over the last few years. We've seen a lot more towards like the action side of things, you know, with the Batman and the recent Hitman title. One of the challenges that I've been analyzing with stealth games that I talked about last week in a series of posts was about balancing between being, you know, stealthy and being powerful. And there's always that pull between, you know, how strong do you make the main character? With Mark of the Ninja, how did you decide, like, how powerful was a ninja going to be? How much should stealth be a factor?
Yeah, well, for us, it was, like, I think often when stealth games go awry is when they try to split that difference, right? It's like, you can be stealthy, or it can just be a shooter, and it's fine both ways. Because it's never actually fine both ways, right?
Yeah.
Because it's like, well, if there's kind of a laborious, complicated way to do a thing, or a really straightforward way, like, people just naturally gravitate toward the thing that is kind of the most successful with the least amount of effort, just because it's like, that's a reasonable way for a human brain to function. So thus, we're like, oh yeah, the game is absolutely about being sneaky, right? Like, and kind of the more of the decisions was, that the player was making was about, like, playstyle approach versus, like, so you can kind of approach the different encounters in all kinds of different ways, but underpinning all of them is you are doing it from a place of concealment. Even if, you know, you are using that concealment to get to a spot where then you can stab a dude or whatever, it's still, like, always about being sneaky. You can't really just run up to a man, punch him in the face, and then have to be good. Because, like, that, like, way, way, way early on, the game kind of supported that, right? And it totally sucked. Like, it was just terrible. Because the whole point was like, well, combat isn't supposed to be good. Like, it's supposed to be kind of punitive, but that wasn't clear, like, the way the game systems were put together, that combat wasn't supposed to, like, it's supposed to not be a good thing, but we had all this emphasis systemically on combat, but it wasn't very good combat, so people would just play it kind of like a brawler, and it would totally suck. And the more we pared down, like, the combat of it, and the more we put in the kind of the feedback systems that a lot of people noted in the game, that's really where the game went from being terrible to being pretty enjoyable to play.
Yeah, and speaking about the feedback system, as you talked about a few minutes ago with the challenge of making a 2D stealth title, you guys really did a good job of giving that feedback of just where the player was, if they could be spotted, can enemy hear me, yes or no? And that's another very underutilized element that I see in a lot of stealth games, of giving the player good feedback into just how, you know, how dangerous their situation is. What was the challenge of creating that kind of feedback system for Mark of the Ninja?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that, God, like 4 or 5 years ago, Kogi Igarashi, one of the main Castlevania guys for a long, long, long time, Symphony of the Night onward, he gave a really good talk about GDC, the Game Developers Conference, kind of like comparing 2D games versus 3D games, and how, like, 2D games are not just 3D games with one less D, that, like, they kind of have these almost, like, fundamental properties that 3D games don't, right? Where they're, like, they're all about, like, precision and very limited play field and, like, really simple camera controls and all this kind of stuff. And kind of what that means is that 2D games end up being, like, far more about, like, exactness and deliberateness just because of all these kind of naturally occurring properties that 2D games have. And that's basically what we were able to leverage for Ninja, where, like, it's definitely true that a lot of 3D stealth games don't really push a lot of feedback. It's also because, like, there's a lot of feedback that has to be communicated, right? Like, you know, how do you in a clean, easily parsable way, like, present some guard's vision cone in a 3D space, right? Like, I mean, you know, Metal Gear totally just comes at it orthogonally and just puts a mini-map up in the corner, but then you spend, like, 90% of the game actually staring at the mini-map in the corner, and you're actually just playing, like, this weird Pac-Man game, and the stuff that, like, is on the majority of the screen, you know, you look at 10% of the time, right? So it's definitely a challenge that someone working in 3D space would have to resolve, that we are able to be, like, a bit more abstract and gamey about it, just because our game is a bit more abstract anyway, because it's 2D, obviously. It's not meant to be a real, like, it's not representing a real, real place. And so because of that, then we could do things like, okay, well, we know under the hood that whenever a noise is made, like, in the game's, like, simulated world, the noise propagates X amount of distance. Well, like, we can just put a visual effect on the screen that is literally that distance. And it just kind of works. And, you know, the same thing with the light and the darkness, the enemy vision cones and all that, that, like, it was just a bit easier for us to be really explicit about that stuff. And because 2D kind of has this characteristic of being very deliberate and exact and precise anyway, it feels like kind of serendipitously almost those two things, like, fit together very nicely.
Yep, and that definitely helped with, as you talk about, trying to balance between the power and being stealthy in that regard. And another area that I really liked about the game was your whole scoring system for it, and how in traditional stealth games, such as like the Hitman series, basically the right way is complete and utter concealment. It's the only way you're going to get, you know, the best ranking or the highest grade. But right. With Mark of the Ninja, the system was free-form enough so that you could adapt, you could do a little bit of action, you could do a little bit of stealth and still come out generally, you know, with, you know, I guess like the 3 marks or like the high medal award for it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, for me, like, scoring systems are never really a thing that is a strong motivation in games for me. So, but I know certainly that other people it is. But kind of what we're able to do is, in addition to just have it be, you know, like a competitive thing with your friends or whatever, it was also another feedback system for us, where it's like, you know, if you don't stab a guy, but rather you distract him, you know, you get this little ding, 200 points distracted thing, as just like, oh, hey, you know, this is a good way to approach this game. And early on, when people are just trying to figure out, like, what the game is about, the fact that those little bits of feedback are there and exist kind of lead people toward playing the game in a way that, like, gives them points and then encourages them to experiment, and then all of a sudden they're actually, like, approaching the encounters in the game in a really player-directed kind of way, which is exactly what we wanted the game to be about. Yeah, and obviously a big part of that is not being prescriptive with, you know, what is the right way to play the game.
And you definitely showed that with the various items and the ninja suits you can unlock through different mm-hmm. achievements. Where did that come from? Like, you had one suit that you could be completely stealthy, but you lost your sword, so you couldn't attack. Or one was, I think, like the aggressive one that you lost all your stealth options, but you're a lot better in sword combat.
I made those up. I mean, yeah, the high-level idea was that each of them was kind of this opt-in specialization for any particular playstyle, where it's like, yeah, basically, as you identified, like, if you want to be the stealth guy and be, like, really hardcore about being concealed, all right, here's the method of play that kind of takes that to the next level. If you want to be really aggressive, you can go this one. If you want to be all about terror, you can go this one. But it's definitely, like, opt-in ways for players to be a bit more specialized and expressive with how they're approaching the game versus, like, I'm always a bit leery of you know, like, ability upgrade systems, which kind of require you to make a decision early on and then commit to that, not really realizing where it's going, right? Like, if there's, you know, like, say, 3 different skill trees and you sink, like, 5 points of a maximum 50 down one tree, well, then unless the game has done, like, a tremendously good balancing job, it's probably suboptimal for you to then switch over to, like, a different playstyle, right? And that kind of sucks, because you're like, oh, I think this one is interesting. Oh, no, actually, it's really lame. But now you've invested, like, you know, a fifth of your advancement down there. So if you want to be successful, you're probably just going to keep going down there anyway.
And so with all like all the different playstyles, the point was definitely to like allow people to kind of be more specialized or expressive with how they're approaching the game, but not in a way that requires them to make like a permanent commitment to doing that.
When you play the game, or when you're like watching people like testing out, what was like, I guess like the general path that people like to play Marvel Ninja? Did they play it completely stealthily? Did they go offense, or did they do some kind of in between?
That's a good question. I don't actually really know. It feels like it's a pretty even distribution of folks, but I don't know if that's just because the people who like to do like the pure stealth route tend to be a little bit more vocal about the fact that they like that. If I had to guess, I'd say it's probably pretty close to even with regard to all the different approaches.
Another question I had was regarding the boss sections, because this is another area that we see a lot of Cell games typically fumble, unless you go like the Metal Gear route, make this completely insane kind of fight.
Right.
How did you come up with like what would be considered the boss fights for the game?
Truth be told, like we never really thought of them as boss fights per se. Partially because, like, you know, the antagonists in the game, they're all just people, right? And, like, if it's just a person and you're a crazy badass ninja and you stab that person with a sword, they're kind of done. So there's really only, like, two of those, like, you know, big encounters in the game. And both of them are more for, like, you know, like, feeling of, like, climax and drama versus... like, this is going to be a crazy, big, challenging thing. But obviously, in both of those situations, it's not about, like, you know, mano-a-mano duking it out with some other character. It's far more about, like, there's just a big, complicated encounter around them. So it's not, like, you're still just kind of playing the game like you've always been playing the game. It's just in, like, a slightly different context, which is, like... If you're going to have, especially in like a stealth game, right? If you're going to have some kind of boss fight type thing, that's almost certainly the way to go. Like the, probably like the best boss fight in a stealth game was the Mr. Freeze fight from City, which was like, it's just like, okay, you have to do all these different things that you normally do anyway, but you have to do some number of them, so you can kind of do it in any order, and you can just do the ones that you naturally find interesting, but then you can't just do the same thing over and over. It was really, really, really good. Like, whoever at Rocksteady implemented that and came up with it should be, like, super proud, because it's it is everything the Human Revolution bosses were not.
By the way, so how do you feel about the Wii U getting an exclusive fix for the boss battles?
That's kind of cool that, like, that they were able to kind of go back and do those things better. That's good. I'm sure the people at IDOS Montreal are kind of happy that they get to sort of buff out the dings in the car, proverbially speaking.
Because I really did love Deus Ex and stealth mechanics, too. It's just that those boss battles were pretty atrocious, and I think that they realized that, too. Just kind of thinks that it's only for the Wii U and not for, people that played on the PC.
Like some kind of Steam patch that would do those things.
That would be excellent, but I guess they got an exclusive deal, so...
Yeah, or, I mean, who knows, they might patch it later.
I hope.
Yeah, you never know. Like, Ubisoft said that, you know, Last of Us, or, no, not Last of Us, the I Am Alive game would never come to the PC, and then, like, a year later, they're like, hey, it's coming to the PC next week.
Well, there you go. So maybe their deal just ended. So, yeah, maybe. There you go.
And again, you answered another question of mine before I asked regarding the boss fight. One of my personal favorites, besides the Mr. Freeze fight, was the end for Metal Gear Solid 3.
Yeah,
that was like another great one. I know we both know that, but I only can actually play Metal Gear Solid 3.
Oh, that's probably my favorite one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like Snake Eater a lot.
Yeah, I still think that was like the... One, I think that's my personal favorite of the Metal Gear Solid games, because it wasn't completely, like, seeped in, you know, like, the crazy Metal Gear Solid mythos.
Yeah, that helps, too. Like, I know some people like it, and I definitely, like, I respect that it isn't just, like, a game about some dudes that are awesome kicking open the door of a place and then wasting all of the people and or aliens and or whatever. That, like, Kojima very clearly has some things that he's trying to say. It's just delivered in a way that often doesn't really appeal to me.
Yeah, it gets just really confusing. And I think that's what turns, a lot of the people who aren't fans of Metal Gear, it turns them off of it, because, I mean, I still don't know exactly what happened at the end of Metal Gear Solid 4. I just remember, like, a 40-minute cutscene, and then I must have fell asleep during it.
Yeah.
I think he's, you know, he ties himself too much to those old film exploitative films, you know, of the 70s. And there's a lot of exposition that goes on, and I don't know, there's better ways to deliver that through gameplay, but, I mean, that's his thing. That's what he's famous for, you know, trying to create that cinematic experience.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, by the way, about Deus Ex, though, I think they actually did a really good job on The Missing Link, because that boss battle was actually appropriate. Just FYI, if you haven't tried that out yet.
I did. I'm trying to remember. Oh, it was just that there was that guy in the office, right?
Right.
He was like, attack a warehouse.
He was a big toted boss, but you could just take him out like anyone else, which is exactly what you said earlier. He's just a person, which is
pretty good. Right, I remember that now. Yeah. But there was like a really complicated space with a bunch of dudes that you had to move through. Yeah, no, that was pretty good. I like that.
I just went behind everyone, just like took them out one at a time. And then just had, like, angry stuff just right. But it was always fun just watch him do, like, the knockout stealth kills, like, spin the guy around, just, like, give him a good punch in the face.
Oh, yeah, here's a question. Have you played Alpha Protocol?
I haven't. I know a lot of people have said, like, it's kind of janky, but it has some really interesting ideas.
That's definitely a
proposition that will appeal to me. I know that I got it on a Steam sale super cheapo at some point in the past. I need to actually just, like, bite the bullet and sit down and play at least some of it.
I'd say it's a really good game, but it's very buggy and a very broken game. But in terms of a stealth game to look at, that's a great one to check out. That thing you talked about earlier with the stealth point, with points and such?
Yeah.
You do tie yourself in eventually. And there's one skill set that's really broken where you can become pretty much invisible. You can stand in front of somebody and you're invisible and you snap their necks.
Yeah.
So you can just pretty much go around invulnerable, invisible, just snapping everyone's necks through the entire, breaking all concept of level design. But
it's like more like the stealth powers. Like, I still don't know like how they like explain the world, but like you just stand there and all of a sudden you just like disappear, and then you can just like, and you can do that like at any time. So, like, you're just, like, walking around, oh, no, guys, spot me, click, and then you're just invisible for, like, 10 seconds. And then it's the rechargeable power, too, so even if you mess up, you can just, you know, hide and go, okay, wait, okay, now let me just go stealth again.
Yeah, and they made the gunplay so bad, you have to do that. They made it, like, the kind of thing where you have to put points into guns, so you, like, keep missing. Like, you're right in front of them, you, like, still miss, so.
Oh, yeah, that's always a tricky thing to balance.
Yeah, and like each gun also had like some kind of like super skill or super shot you could do. I think like the handgun, it basically stops time and you can like put like tags on where you want to shoot the enemy. So that was like a trick for the boss fight. You could just like tag like 8 tags on the guy's head and then unpause. Bang, 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 bang.
But that game also suffered the same problem with Deus Ex. It had a boss battle where it forced you to be lethal. So, I mean, that game, even though it has some stellar things about the game in terms of how it makes choices, in terms of its stealth mechanic and its focus on, am I a stealth game or not a stealth game, it's pretty strange. But
right. That sounds like what I've heard people say about it.
It's definitely a flawed gem. It's definitely not a game you're going to play because it's, you know, this excellent, you know, well-designed title, but it did a lot of things very differently that we don't see done before in the genre.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm always happy for a thing that has some weird ideas that are good, even if the rest of it is maybe a little bit dicier.
Yeah. A little bit broken.
Yeah.
And I had Ken's problem in Human Revolution. I was okay with the first fight, but the second and third ones were just such a pain in the ass for me. Because I went stealth pistols, And of course, this is like the game where pistols are like the weakest weapon. So you're fighting against, you know, a guy with like a automatic rail gun with poking, with a poking field.
The secret is get the Typhoon, and then that's all you need. Just use it 3 times, and whatever hits, it kills. That's what how I dealt with all that stuff.
So let's move on. So with the art style, I guess one thing, as Ken said, was that the animations were very well. I also, and that was definitely seen in Mark of the Ninja, you guys had some very brutal stealth kill animations.
Oh, yeah. So one of our guys spent probably like 2 or 3 months contiguously just animating all the different stealth kills.
I guess another question that I have regarding Mark of the Ninja in terms of like design was just like the general enemy design. Because as we've been talking about, one of the issue, as we talk about in terms of general detection and player strength, another factor of that are the enemies that you're facing. If you're up against, you know, an enemy who can see you, you know, from 30 feet away, it's very hard to do stealth. But likewise, if you got a guy who you can basically like walk circles around him until you like the exclamation point pops, it's not that bad. How did you go about balancing out the different enemies in the game?
Yeah, I mean that's definitely part of the challenge, right? Is that like because so much of the gameplay takes place before the enemies even know where you are. Like, just giving them more hit points or different attacks or whatever doesn't really make a difference for the majority of the people the majority of the time. So what we had to do was figure out ways to kind of make the enemies kind of like pre-detection behaviors interesting, right? That, like, you know, even when they don't see you, the things you have to do to remain undetected have to be different. And so that's like kind of how, like, you know, obviously you're just kind of meat and potatoes normal guard guy, and then there's another guard that, like, whenever he's distracted, he shoots a flare, so now there's a light source wherever you made the distraction. So if you're trying to, like, you know, make a noise behind him and get him to turn around, oh, that area is now illuminated, so you can't just use that to sneak up and stab in the back. Then there are kind of the, you know, the dogs that can smell you even when it's in the darkness, and the enemies that have night vision goggles, etc. That it was all about, like, primarily it was about, like, yeah, making sure that what the player had to do, even when they weren't, like, immediately about to stab a guard, was really interesting. Because if it's just, like, if guys, you know, have, like, 15 different builds and look all these different ways, but if all you do to all of them is make a noise behind them and then stab them in the back when they turn around, they're actually not really very different. You can make them look different however much you want, but it doesn't actually matter.
Yeah, they don't have the same problem as Alpha Protocol with the dominant strategy of turning invisible and snapping everyone's neck.
Right, yeah.
And as you were talking about, with each guy having different tactics or different detection abilities, once again, the feedback system was really important to show all that to the player.
Right, yeah. So the night vision guys have kind of a different looking vision cone that's always rendering, and then, you know, the dogs have, like, their sniffy aura and all that. So yeah, that was also a component of the whole communicativeness of it, is that, like, the guys, not only do they behave differently, but the player can look at them and immediately understand that they are indeed different, and then kind of internalize how they need to change their behavior.
Another question that I have regarding just like actual like stealth design. As you mentioned at the beginning of the cast, you drew a lot of inspiration from, you know, Hitman, Metal Gear, Thief, and those types of games. In terms of, like, your own personal preference, do you like stealth games that are about, I guess, like, hiding using, you know, light, sound? Or do you like more, like, the ones that you're hiding in plain sight, like Assassin's Creed or Hitman?
That's a good question. I don't know, they offer kind of slightly different things, I guess. Like, Hitman Blood Money is one of my favorite games ever, along with, like, Thief. I like that they kind of offer different things, because one is, like, about literally concealing your position, right? Like, be in a place where enemies can't see you, and the other one is kind of, like, about concealing your identity or your intent, right? Which is also interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I like both.
Yeah, I find myself, I'm definitely fascinated by Hitman style. I really have to, like, sit down and, like, play one of the older ones. I bought Absolution, I think, 2 weeks ago, and it was okay, but it definitely felt a little more simplified from what I heard that's traditional of the series.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I also own Absolution, but I haven't played it yet. But yeah, no, definitely, if you haven't, go back and get Blood Money. The tutorial mission is terrible, but after that, it gets really, 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 really good.
All right.
Yeah. How about Dishonored? Have you guys tried that yet?
Oh my god, I love Dishonored so much. I played Knife of Dunwall a couple weeks ago, and it just reminded, like, I played Dishonored when it first came out back in, like, what, September, October, whatever it was. And then I kind of played it through, finished it, hadn't touched it, and then Knife of Dunwall came out, and I got it, but didn't play it for a while, and I finally played it a couple weekends ago, and it just reminded me how much I love Dishonored. Oh my god, it's so good.
Now, did you play stealthy, or did you play the other way, aggressive?
I did. I was mostly sneaky, yeah.
Because everyone always talks about how a lot of the powers are for, like, aggression and straight-up killing, and it's actually more fun to play that way over the stealthy part of it. But...
not really. I mean, like, only really two. Like, obviously, there isn't a lot of use for the wind blast thing if you're not, like, alerting guys. Most of the other one, like, that was actually one of the things I enjoyed about the game the most, is that most of the abilities were very flexible, right? Like, you can use stop time to, like, waste a bunch of dudes, or you can use it to, like, get across a very busy, well-controlled area without being seen. You can do the same thing with Possession and Blink. Like, I thought they actually did a really good job of being very flexible in terms of the, like, how the abilities are used.
Yeah. This is a few of them were focused around killing, but I really did love Blink. Blink is amazing. I didn't realize how much that would change a stealth game.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And in Knife of Dunwall, whenever you blink, like, whenever you're holding down the button to aim where your blink is going to go, they actually stop time. Oh, my God, and it's so good.
I still haven't played Dishonored yet, sadly. It's on my list of games to buy at some point.
Well, if you want to have an interesting experience playing it, try it with a Hydra controller, which is a motion controller. Oh. It gets you, it's pretty dizzying, but it's an interesting experience to play a stealth game with the motion controls, because you're always kind of moving, which is a little odd.
Interesting.
Well, my goal is to actually play it with an Oculus Rift, so have Rift with the motion controls and Dishonored together. See how dizzied I'd get.
See how long you can go before you have to barf.
Did Clay pick up an Oculus Rift?
We haven't, no, but I don't know. Because obviously, like, our games, right, it's not like a 3D immersive world, so it's, I don't think we'd make a Rift thing anytime soon. I was super, super, super skeptical about it. Like, I was just like, this, like, this stuff has been around since the 90s, and it's always dumb. and then some of my friends from Seattle, they did get one, and they brought it up here. I put it on. Within, like, 10 seconds, I'm like, I have seen the face of angels, and I believe this is unreal. No pun intended, I guess. It is really, really, really goddamn cool, and I thought it would be the stupidest thing in the world. So yeah, that's awesome. Except I got in for about 10 minutes, and then I was like, yeah, I need to stop or I'm gonna barf.
Yeah, because think about blinking in Dishonored with Oculus Rift. It would get pretty vomit-inducing pretty fast, especially when you, like, blink multiple times in a row.
Yeah,
you would get so disoriented. But the only reason I asked that is because, like, I would assume, like, hey, maybe someone just have it as a play toy to experiment and stuff with. So I'm trying to convince the guy that smugged me to buy an Oculus Rift so we can play around with it. Because I have this, that's the only thing I'm waiting for is the Oculus Rift to actually ship and come. Right now I'm just stuck in limbo waiting for it.
Right.
I also remember back in the 90s when, like, VR was going to be the next big thing. And I actually did play one of those things, you know, they put, like, the giant helmet on your head and you're just, like, standing around trying to aim with that thing.
Yeah.
That was just horrible back then.
You know, they actually made an Omni track. It's been kickstarted, and it's just pretty much so it stimulates walking. So that was a major problem with VR, is that no matter what scenario, you don't feel like you're moving. So there you go. So maybe that's featuring an Oculus Rift connected with a Omni track with some motion controls. There you go. You have a little bit closer to complete VR.
We're going to get to The Lawnmower Man very soon.
No one knows what that movie is. At least
I embarrassingly have definitely seen one.
Yeah,
I think I've seen both of them, actually.
There's a second one. Oh, yeah, there's a second one.
Yeah, there is. We don't talk about that one.
By the way, those graphics still hold up to this day, let me tell you.
The original, yeah.
It's a trippy piece of art, I would say.
And that's what we were all hoping VR was going to be.
Well, we all thought Virtual Boy was going to be the next step to VR, which was horrible. I just tried it the other day. A friend of mine had it. And my eyes still burn, by the way. I have, like, red lines forever burning my eyes.
I remember trying that at, like, a Blockbuster. I think it was, like, 96. And, oh, my God. I was like, I did it for, like, 10. I was like, okay, I gotta stop this. Get me away from this. I think that's, like, still, like, on record as, like, the biggest crash from Nintendo. The biggest failing was the Virtual Boy.
Over Rob? Or the robot?
Yeah. I think the rumor is it actually got one of their key designers fired. The guy who came up with it, who was pretty famous, whose name completely escapes me right now.
Doesn't seem very famous then, does he?
I think he was the creator of Metroid, too.
Shigesato Itoi? Is that it? No, Gunpei Yokoi.
That's it, yeah.
Oh, okay. So going back, I had a question, I just remembered it. But, so, is Clay going to start supporting the Wii U? Have you guys gotten SDK and all that stuff going?
No, we don't have one. There's two things, right? There's, like, porting existing games, and that's a bit tricky just because of, like, contractual obligations and all that. And doing new things, I mean, like, if we had the right idea for it, sure. I mean, but obviously, like, you know, we've got a million bloody ideas and only a relatively small number of people to execute upon them. So it's more a question about resources than, like, anything else.
Yeah, and the only reason I say that is because recently they started to waive fees and stuff for those kits, so that maybe you guys would have picked one up.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's awesome. We haven't yet, but, like, that doing that kind of thing, just to lower the barriers for entry for people making games on that platform, fantastic.
Yeah,
fantastic.
The WiiWare itself has been, I would say, pretty abysmal in terms of it competing with Xbox Live Arcade and stuff like that. It's because they don't, I mean, they force indies to have a workspace, like a lot of independents don't. So, that's one nice thing they waived, so.
Yeah, no, it's good. Like, in an amazingly short amount of time, and I think this is good, I think it's a testament to the fact that, like, unlike, you know, kind of Sony and Microsoft, which are, like, they make video games and consoles, but they are also part of massive corporations that have all these other interests, like, Nintendo is just a video games company. And they basically modernized, like, all their digital stuff in, like, a year, right? Like,
right.
Like, went from WiiWare, which is really clunky and very hard to use, and now, like, every single 3DS game ships day and date downloadable. Like, I bought Fire Emblem Advance just, like, on my DS by clicking two buttons. I cannot imagine that kind of, like, deep institutional change happening in, like, 12 months from either Sony or Microsoft, just because there's, like, so many moving pieces in those organizations. And that's really cool, I think, that Nintendo can, like, have the ability to pivot like that. And hopefully that's something they'll be able to continue doing and just kind of, you know, make it easier and easier to make games for their platform.
Yeah, I think that's what they need to do, is they need to get more third-party support, and the best way is to tap into the independent scene.
Let's see. And hopefully Nintendo can keep making those changes, because as we all know, they recently did their whole YouTube attack last week regarding, you know, the Let's Play accounts.
Oh, yeah. Their PR is not very good of recent, I guess because of did you hear about that, right?
Yeah, vaguely familiar.
Yeah. Basically, there, anyone who puts up any videos of Nintendo games, they want all the ad revenue from that, regardless of, I think based on, like, how much length. So, like, if a Let's Play video or someone doing commentary, they're demanding all that ad revenue.
Yeah, that's kind of weird. I mean, it's sort of like, it's free marketing for your stuff, right? Just, like, just take it as free marketing, and that's, like, that's fine. Right? Like, people are evangelizing your stuff. Like, that's good. Like, you just want them to do that.
I mean, you should make an announcement that Clay is all cool with that.
We did. Like, there's a big old, like, chunk of some part of Don't Starve's website, which is like, if you want to do videos of our games, blah, 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 all this other stuff, it's all totally fine. We would just love it if you link back to where people can get the game. And that's it. Like, that's all you need to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone wins in that scenario. But,
yeah,
you know, I think they need to actually make an announcement of some kind to kind of address this. But until they don't, they're going to have some bad PR.
Yeah.
Here's a question I have for both of you, since everyone here is familiar with stealth games. What do you guys think about, like, the whole Assassin's Creed series? Do you consider them stealth games? Because I'm not quite sure I would label them as stealth the same way as, like, Metal Gear or Hitman.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's, it has less of an emphasis, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does to an extent, but they're also, like, very, you know, high action drama cinematic in a literal sense. I mean, there's some vestiges of it there, but it's certainly not like fundamental the way it is in other things like Metal Gear and Dishonored, and etc.
All right, moving on. I guess this will sort of be a good lead-in to talking about the Mark of Ninja Special Edition. Sure. The only real complaints I have about Mario Ninja was that I want more to play of it, which by itself is not exactly like the most horrible thing you can say about a game.
That's a good problem to have.
Were there any elements of Mario Ninja that were, you know, left on the cutting room floor, or was like everything you wanted just pretty much in the game?
Yeah, no, basically everything we wanted was in there. Like, there weren't any things that we kind of deliberately excised just because it's like, oh, this would be nice to have, but we don't have the time to get it up to snuff or whatever. So it was actually kind of challenging, like, doing all this stuff for the Special Edition DLC because, like, we kind of explored all the territory we'd allotted ourselves, which is why we ended up thinking about it more like a, you know, Special Edition, like the, you know, it's like, what would the Criterion Collection version of the game look like, right? Where this isn't, you know, like some expansion. This is more for, like, you know, I mean, nobody buys the Criterion Collection version of a movie they've never seen just because they think they might like it, right? Like, you get the Criterion Collection version because it's a movie you really enjoy, but you kind of want to know more of it, know more about it, that kind of stuff. So that was kind of the approach we took, and when we thought about it that way, you know, we were able to kind of figure out what kind of stuff we can add and how, you know, it could be interesting in that regard. So, you know, the Special Edition DLC is like 50-50 new stuff and then the additional developer commentary. So, yeah, we added a new level, a couple new items, like a new playstyle, but then we also went back and in all the main game levels, as well as the new level, added between, like, what's the smallest? It's like 7 or 8 and, like, 12 different, like, little commentary notes per level. Nice. So there's 130 in total or something obscene like that. And, you know, it's just a whole bunch of different people from the team weighed in about different stuff. So there's like, you know, I scribbled a bunch of stuff about design, and then our main environment artist, she added a bunch of stuff, and our audio guy added a bunch of stuff about the sound design and how we did Foley and the music. It's really cool. Like, actually, just as I was compiling all that stuff and putting it into the game and wrangling all the various translations of it and blah, 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 like, I learned a couple details that I didn't even know about the game, and I was like, oh, this is really cool. And it's a thing that I really wish more games did.
Yeah.
Like, almost, like, even, you know, the most boring, like, mid-run Matthew McConaughey, like, romantic comedy will get a director's commentary on it, on its DVD, right? But, like, almost no games ever have any kind of commentary. And that sucks, because it's like, you know, it's, I mean, just personally for me, it's really interesting, but it also, like, humanizes the craft and, like, kind of demystifies the process a little bit, which is good, I think. And so, you know, kind of be the change you want to see in the world, I guess. So we did all we needed to do to get that commentary in the Special Edition, and that's probably the thing I'm the most jazzed about it.
Yeah, we definitely don't see a lot. I think the only company that I remember that still does it would be Valve. Because there always seems to be the commentary on that, but yeah, you're right. I would like to see more of that, especially like in like design heavy games, even something like Mario or even just like the latest BioShock. It'd be interesting to like get inside a developer's head about, and how the game came together.
Yeah. Apparently, the thing that kind of inspired us the most, just in terms of presentation, was Brendan Cheung's 30 Flights of Loving. Like, he has like a director's commentary on there that's super interesting. And I didn't realize this. I certainly never played it this way. But as I've been talking about the Ninja Special Edition commentary, apparently Remedy did a version, maybe it was the PC version, I'm not sure, of Alan Wake that had a bunch of commentary stuff in there too, which I think would be really interesting because that game, you know, was in development for a really long time, and it's interesting, but some stuff about it is like kind of funky. So it seems like that's the kind of game that would like that kind of stuff would be super interesting. Or if like
just note though, the Humble Bundle, there's the Humble Bundle for Alan Wake and American Nightmare Collector's Edition.
Oh, that's right, I saw that today. Yeah, so yeah, this is timely indeed. So yeah, maybe that's, I imagine that the commentary versions of both those games would be in there. And so if that's a thing people check out, they should totally get those.
Didn't Max Payne have a commentary track? The original, not the latest one?
I have no idea. Maybe. I mean, that was also Remedy, right? So
right.
Maybe that's the thing they like to do, in which case that's super cool.
Yeah. I mean, I would just say, just for everyone about Alan Wake, if you don't have it, definitely pick it up. Humble Bundle, any price you want. And if you really love Max Payne, I think Alan Wake's more of a spiritual sequel to Max Payne than Max Payne 3 was. So, there you go.
I also like, just like as a general like horror game, had interesting twists on just like how you will avoid these enemies. There's like really good like run for your life kind of feel to it.
Or more like get running because he's always out of breath. It's like,
Definitely.
That would just like be me though with my allergies right now. That'd just be me. Oh no, there's someone coming at me. Run 3 feet. Oh, can't breathe.
Drop a flare. Can't breathe. Drop a flare. All right.
Yeah, definitely for a game that you can pay whatever you want for. Alan Wake is definitely worth checking out. And I live up here in the Pacific Northwest, so it's like it definitely kind of captures that like kind of rural-ish logging town, you know, in like the Olympic Peninsula or the Sunshine Coast or whatever. Yeah, it's cool. It's a game that I feel like when I think about the time I started with it, I like it more than it seems like I should have, which is cool.
Yeah, and listen, they brought in some cool things from the Max Payne, Max Payne series too, like the television series, like what's it called?
Something Falls.
Dark Falls.
Is it Dark? Is it Dark? It's gonna be too obvious.
Don't think it's Dark, but Something Falls. You're right.
It's like a Midnight Falls or Twilight Falls or something. Oh God, yeah, those weird like super like Twilight Zone-y but not things or yeah. Actually really, really cool and weird, and I like them more than it feels like I should have.
Yeah, it was and it's your choice. You can sit there and watch it or you can leave. So
yeah.
But Max Payne did the same thing with a different like Dick Justice and Lords and Ladies.
Oh, that's right. I completely forgot about that.
Right. And if you watch those, you just sit there and watch them, and they're very interesting because again they're analogous to what's happening to the main character. Or not.
Oh my God, I completely forgot about that. That's the thing that Remedy has done for a really, really, really long time. Oh God, that's so weird.
Listen, I love Max Payne too. I actually have a cutout that I bought at a convention once. It's like it's in my storage room, but it's still there. I'm not allowed to take it out, but it's one of my prizes. My dorky prizes.
No, I like the first two Max Payne games a lot too, and I kind of like the third one as well for different reasons.
But yeah, it's not the same. It's a different kind of feel entirely. But if
it's very much a Michael Mann movie.
Yeah. Alan Wake definitely. If you love Max Payne, Alan Wake is definitely to go.
Yeah, the expansion, the American Nightmare one, it was okay. It was a lot more simplified. It didn't have like a lot of like mystique of the first one, but it had like a good feel. I hope they do continue the series, especially if for those of you who just bought the regular version, especially get the DLC for Alan Wake. I think it had two mini episodes that were released. They did a pretty good job of basically making a lot more challenging, a lot more about like the nightmare. So it got a lot closer to like the Max Payne, you know, nightmare cutaway levels.
No one liked those though. That's from my memory. Well, Max Payne 1 had that nightmare level that everyone despised.
The cradle maze. You got like the baby crying in the background.
You would, like, you would fall and you would die like every second. You'd be like, oh, is this, I can stand on this? No, I can't. I'm dead. So, I mean, one of those levels everyone wants to skip, but yeah.
Alright, getting back to the Mark and Ninja Special Edition, the new level that you were designing, is that something that's going supposed to be like a take place after the main game or during the main game?
No. I mean, obviously, we both narratively and mechanically, we built Ninja to be like very self-contained, right? And okay. And Ninja ends with finality that is certainly conclusive on purpose. The way it's presented is kind of like one of the other characters in the game, Dosan, like the old tattoo artist guy. He's kind of like telling you a story of something he did before when he was younger. And all badass and stuff. So it's kind of like, it's a flashback, but it's a flashback, sort of a flashback, but to like a different character. So it doesn't really like have, I mean, it sets up some of the stuff that happens in the game narratively, but it's not like, here's what happened between level 4 and level 5 or anything like that. It's definitely kind of its own little thing.
Okay. And you say you're adding in new items as well. Is there going to be like a new suit as well with that?
Yep, exactly.
Let's see. So, when do you have an idea it's going to be released?
When it's done. I mean, it's almost done. Really, like I'm kind of, my list of stuff to do for it is dwindling rapidly. But because it's going to be on both Xbox and PC, it has to obviously be certified through Microsoft, which can take hopefully not too long, but we don't know exactly how long. It should be sometime this summer. We just gotta, you know, figure out when.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. We were talking with Kevin, a few weeks ago at Don't Start, about how some of the issues with when you're trying to create the game for XBLA, and I think he mentioned that you guys were forced to add in like the high score list for Mark of the Ninja. I think that was like one of the...
No, I mean, like, just as a platform requirement, Xbox Live Arcade, you did need to have a leaderboard of some sort. But, I mean, the leaderboard could literally just be, you get 1 point for finishing the game, and that's it. Like, you know, Telltale did stuff on Xbox with Wallace and Gromit, and what leaderboards do you have in a Telltale game, right? So their leaderboards were like, how many conversations did you have with the person? So we were forced in the sense that it's like a platform requirement that everybody has to do, but, you know, obviously we try to make, I think we did make good use of the way the scoring system worked. Yeah. That it was a feedback mechanism. It wasn't just kind of like a number that goes into the ether that you never look at again.
Definitely. So with the Mark and Ninja Special Edition, with that wrapping up shortly, are you thinking about making like a sequel at some point to Mark and Ninja?
I have no idea. I don't think any of us would be satisfied creatively. Just like. Making another set of 12 levels and kicking it out the door and saying, we're good. If we had, like, you know, an idea, because I think that, you know, kind of the low-lying mechanics are still, like, pretty ripe. And if there was some interesting idea we had to do with those, sure, that can be really cool. But as to what that might be, I have no idea if that's a thing we would do or not.
Yeah, and I can definitely respect that. I think that's a really great thing about a lot of the indie companies who can, you know, they can just keep making these unique ideas, and they don't have to be, like, tied down to one genre or one specific series.
Right. Yeah.
And Don't Starve is definitely a step in the interesting direction.
Yeah, it's cool. That it's, like, a very kind of iterative, it grows over time thing. Yeah, it's cool. It's definitely, it's been very interesting, kind of, because aside from, like, you know, I played Don't Starve for, like, a couple times during development and just, like, gave them a big old list of feedback, but that was, like, literally the extent of my connection, you know, with the game. So kind of just watching that come together from afar was definitely interesting.
Here's a question for you. Do you ever think about attaching Mark the Ninja with the Steam, with the TF2 hat? Don't Starve did it.
Yeah, why? I think it was because it had already come out on Xbox. We couldn't do that.
Darn it.
I think.
I like that. Yeah. I'm going to ask every developer that comes on that question. Do you think about, like, releasing a TF2 hat?
Gotta get all the hats.
Yeah. Listen, hats are money and love. But it's commodity market.
He's the resident TF2 player of the group.
Nice.
I think that should do it. Ken, do you have any other questions you want to follow up with?
Oh, I think I'm good.
Cool.
Okay, so I think we're going to end here. Nels, it was great having you on. Thanks for being on the cast with us this week.
Yeah, thank you very much, guys. That was cool.
And definitely, if you would like to come back, you are always welcome.
Sure, that would be fun at some point when we have something more to talk about.
Alright, so with that said, we're going to wrap it up here. And as always, I'd like to end the cast with saying that if, for those of you listening, would like to be a future guest on the cast or just write a quick piece for the site, you can find a link to that on our front page under submissions wanted. And with that, we're going to end it here. Thanks for listening to the cast this week, and we'll talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.